I never know what I'm supposed to say in that part.
You're supposed to say a podcast.
A podcast of the cinema. Of fine. The cinema. Okay. Well,
hosted by you, Alonzo Duralde.
Yes. And you, Dave White.
That's right.
And brought to you by Dave White's audio memoir, Exile in Guyville, available at exileinguyvillebook.tumblr.com.
You're getting it wrong.
What am I getting wrong?
Well, not the URL. That was correct.
Mm-hmm.
It's not an audio memoir. It's an audiobook.
Of a memoir.
That I wrote that was a book first. What if people don't know? What if people don't know what it is? See, here's the thing.
What, they think you just freestyle jazzed it and didn't write any of it down?
If they're listening to this podcast, then they have every reason to believe that that's what I did.
Well, okay, it's fine. The audiobook.
Let me explain.
Of
it.
Your book.
Let me lay it
that
down.
You wrote. That was once on dead tree paper and now is in the air of wordy talk. Better?
I was bestowed with a book deal a long time ago. And they said, hey, do you have a book? I said, I do. I'm going to write this book for you. And I did. They published it. They went out of business. And, now I'm giving you this audiobook version. There. It's, but I'm told by a good handful of people, some of whom are not even my close friends, that it's not bad.
Well, all right.
And the book was published in 2010. The audiobook was orated,
recorded
by me in 2015. You can go to that URL. What is it again?
ExileInGuyvilleBook.tumblr.com.
You can pay anything you want for it. Any amount of money. $1? $1 million?
I'm still waiting for that one to come.
What you got? I'll take whatever it is that you have. Also, this podcast is brought to you by us on Patreon. The Club Linoleum Knife.
Yes.
I don't know. Is that, we haven't really been calling it anything.
No.
We've just been saying, join our club.
Yeah.
You go to Patreon, Patreon.
.com/linoleumknife.
Right. And you find out, first of all, you watch the great video. There's a video of me and you explaining everything.
Yes.
And being great and eating muffins.
Correct.
Then on the side of the page of Patreon is all the different levels. All the different levels at which you can be a club member.
Correct.
There's the cheap level. That's my personal favorite. $4 a month.
It's very reasonable.
And it gets you the podcast of the television, LKTV.
Yes.
Where we sit around and talk about what we watched on TV week long.
Yes.
Then
it's more complicated than that.
I don't think it is.
We have deep things to say
Don't oversell
Eurovision.
Then at different other higher levels, $7, $12, $16, $20.
They're very reasonable.
You got a lot of other things. We just learned how reasonable these levels are.
Oh, this is a we now?
I learned it first, and then I brought home the information, and you learned it. Mm. We learned it almost simultaneously. So, at different levels, you get different content.
Yes.
You get the Linoleum Knife Presents More Linoleum Knife episodes.
Extra episodes, yes.
You get
At certain levels, you get a copy of that audiobook.
You get a copy of that as audiobook at a certain level. You get t-shirts. You get tote bags. You get zines that I'm creating. You get, the first one's called Endless Donuts, and it's almost finished being wrote by me on the computer.
You get to come to our club meetings at certain levels.
Once a month.
Where we stream a film and
all together
hang out at a Google Hangout and talk about it before, during, and after. Last night we watched Otto Preminger's Laura.
And the top levels, you get a thing called LK Selector, where we select something.
Yes.
For you. It's like a present.
And that first one will be happening soon.
All kinds of prizes. Great prizes that you get. Well, here's what I learned this week. One of the prizes that you can select for yourself is the linoleum knife mug. A beautiful black mug with the linoleum knife logo on it. It says linoleum knife in big white letters, and underneath it says a podcast of the cinema.
Be real cool at your office.
I went to the post office to ship out the first batch of mugs. Like, some of y'all are going to get them like Monday or Tuesday. They didn't all go out at once. You know, I can carry two tote bags of mugs to the post office at a time, walking in my neighborhood. That's about that's a reasonable amount of tote bags full of mugs.
We could get you some of those long sticks and you could hang some tote bags from either end.
I learned that it costs $11 to ship a mug. And here's the funny thing. If you're at the $7 level, you could have a mug. So basically.
But only after 2 months.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you know.
But you get other stuff too. So you're killing us, Smalls. This is the kind of thing that you'd think we would have known before setting the price levels. And I mistakenly assumed that Dave White, being the anal retentive, detail freak, I need all the information guy that he is, surely would have put a mug in a box with some bubble wrap and taken it to the post office first and said, hey, how much is this going to cost to ship?
That is such a good idea.
Yeah, that I wish you'd had.
I didn't have that idea. I just went to the internet and looked up weights and how much things would cost. And then I assumed. I assumed that these mugs were not over 1 pound. They're actually 1 pound and 10 ounces in the box with the bubble wrap and stuff. And so then suddenly, boom, it costs all this money to send the mug. Here's the thing. Don't feel sorry for us.
It all works out in the
end. It all works out in the end. It's not like we're, you know, it's not like we're paying you to get a mug. But it's a funny thing that I learned this week about being
hilarious.
Stupid. I learned that I should be less stupid.
Yes.
This week.
And that's always a good lesson.
And so, you know, if you've chosen a mug, that's exciting for everyone.
It's coming your way.
When you get your mug, you should drink out of it, or you should, like I said on LKTV this week, you should fill it with candy and give it to your friends. Not the mug, the candy. Turn it into a candy dish.
And then they will mentally associate delicious, yummy candy with linoleum knife.
A podcast of the cinema, which they in turn will then be like, hey, how can I learn more about this? Should I listen? Should I also subscribe? And you will say, you sure should. And get a mug, because it costs them $11 to send it to you.
Hey.
I'm dumb.
Yes. Okay.
You know what I'm smart about, though?
Do tell.
Filmic things. And I'm really good at making this tea.
You're also good at shutting down fools.
Oh, yeah. Do you follow me on Twitter, you guys? You listeners? I'm at D. Leland White on Twitter. And last night on Twitter, I told the story. It is a story that happened to me yesterday when I went to the Lemley Royal Theater over on the far west side of Los Angeles to see Terrence Davies' Sunset Song, his latest film. Now, Sunset Song is about a young woman in the early 20th century in rural Scotland. She's tall and beautiful, and that's part of her character. To get that effect on camera, they hired model Agnes Dane to play her. If you don't know who Agnes Dane is, you should go look up the words Sunset Song and look at her in that movie, and then look up the words Agnes Dane, the model, and look at those pictures that are in Vogue and stuff, and you are not really looking at the same person.
I'm not that familiar with her modeling
except
work,
height-wise.
So.
I mean, you'll see her in Wild, you know, Haute Couture.
I see, gotcha.
And in this movie, she's in, you know, drab.
She's wearing a lot of sacks.
Yeah. Anyway, so, and her name is not spelled A-G-N-E-S. It's A-G-Y-N-E-S-S. Yeah.
D-E-Y-N.
Yeah, it's complicated spelling. But she...
Who does she think she is with all those letters?
Somebody. She wasn't even born with that name.
Oh, really?
Yeah, she turned it into that name later in life.
Engelbert Humperdinck.
Yeah. So, so she plays a young woman in Scotland. The most bonny lass in Blueary. What a good name for a place. Blueary. You know? Apparently that's a real place in Scotland. And she lives with her farmer family. Her dad is played by Peter Mullen.
So, of course, he's the worst.
So, yeah, so he's a nightmare walking. And she is smart. She is studious. She can speak French. She's studying Latin. She wants to be a teacher. And everyone in the village around her is like, learning is no good for you.
It makes people think they're better than
they are. It makes people think they're better than everyone else around them. And, you know, the funniest thing about that is that's exactly what it does. And what it and the reason it makes them think that is because it does then make them better than you.
That's a bit of an overstatement, but I see what you mean.
Listen, some of the meanest people I ever met in my whole damn life were uneducated people.
Oh, I know.
In my family.
But look, so, I know some awful smart people and very valuable.
But there's a special kind of meanness to the uneducated.
Well,
and
here's what it is. It's the aggressively uneducated. It's like not the ones who lacked the means or the access or whatever, but the ones who just outright were like, no, don't want it.
Yeah, let me be more specific. The uneducated and the willfully stubbornly ignorant.
Yes.
The ones who are uneducated and who say, I don't need that. And if you go get it, then I hate you. That's really...
Yeah.
That's who I'm talking about.
I gotcha.
No, I mean, please. I'm uneducated on a variety of subjects. I don't feel great about that, and I should learn more about those subjects. Math, for example, which will never happen, because the numbers are upside down and backwards in my head.
But you don't resent the people who...
No, I worship them, actually, because I just think, oh, that thing that you can do that I'll never be able to do. Adding. Who invented that?
Somebody Greek.
Right. So.
Or Chinese, I don't know.
The folks all around her, like, the folks all around her and the people I knew growing up who were like this would literally say the same thing to me. Oh, you think college is going to make you better than me? You think book learning is all you need? Book learning. That's what they say in Texas. You think all that book learning you're going to get is better, going to make you better than me? And I would always say, no, don't yell at me. And then inside I'd think, yes. Yes, in fact, it will. In fact, I'm already better than you.
I was going to say, it doesn't take much.
So that's what they do to her. And a series of unfortunate events befall her because it's the early 20th century in Scotland, in the rural part of the world, where people cling to... You know, religion and the drink and beating their families and stuff like that. And so her dreams of becoming a teacher, they are lost. And then she meets a young man who is the male equivalent of Agnes Dane. About 4 inches shorter than she is, but then I think most people are 4 inches shorter than Agnes Dane. But when the camera hits that young man's face, it's like light pours out of it. And I can only think of it when you see him. His name is Kevin Guthrie, the name of the actor, playing Ewan. And Agnes Dane plays Christine, or Chris. She calls herself Chris. Everyone who calls her Chrissy, she corrects them. She's like, it's Chris. The light pours out of this man's face in a way that, you know, Luchino Visconti and Rocco and His Brothers
would admire.
Yeah, Gus Van Sant in Good Will Hunting. The way he lit Matt Damon in that movie.
The way Joel Schumacher lights Colin Farrell in Tigerland.
Oh yeah, Colin Farrell's buttocks most specifically. And it was just, you know, not the point of the film, but queer.
But it's another gay director.
Yeah, queer filmmakers often. The ones who care about how things look.
Yeah.
They do this. They bathe their creations in the way
Almodovar shoots Gael Garcia Bernal in Bad Education.
The way Almodovar shoots Penelope Cruz as well.
Well, yeah, he mostly does it to women, but I was trying to think of a male equivalent.
Almodovar, for a gay director, is fairly bisexual in terms of his cinematography.
I think he platonically, you know, worships his actresses, and then I think he's a little lustier with his men.
Maybe. In any case, she meets Ewan, and their love is to watch it happen on screen. It's like someone is feeding you the most delicious blueberry pie. You lean forward to watch them just kiss each other. Just look at each other.
Yeah.
The way they look at each other. And it reminded me, in a less corny way, of the way whatever his name is, looks at Saoirse Ronan in Brooklyn.
Oh,
That mooning sort of, like, I must enfold you into me, you know.
Yeah, that's true. That's a good comparison.
And then more unfortunate events happen. And so this is a film about suffering.
Yeah.
But not in
a masochistic kind of way.
Not in a masochistic way, not in a sadistic way. It's
just like, look, it's a farm, it's Scotland, it's the early 20th century.
And that's World War One happens. Made a film that was set before, I mean, I'm sorry, Terrence Davies has never made a movie set after like 1950 something.
That's true. Yeah, he lives in the period.
He explores, you know, the lives of people in distant times.
Yeah. Did you ever see his film of the Neon Bible?
I have not seen the Neon Bible.
I did not care for it.
I know. You've mentioned that every time it comes up.
Does it come up that often?
Whenever Terrence Davies comes up, you bring up the Neon Bible and how you didn't like it. And I always tell you, I didn't see it. These are these cyclical conversations.
Welcome to marriage.
That married people have. And it's always the same conversation. And one person in the partnership says, yes, you've told me this. This is now the 11th time you've told me this. Over the past 21 years.
Sometimes I am that person.
Sometimes.
Yes. Don't pretend like I'm not.
But in general.
No. There are some Davies movies I loved. The Deep Blue Sea. I love The Long Day Closes. Less crazy about Neon Bible and what was the first one?
Distant Voices Still Lives.
I still haven't seen The House of Mirth.
The House of Mirth is fantastic. The Deep Blue Sea may be my favorite.
That might be mine, too.
My favorite of the more recent ones.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting.
The Long Day Closes is, you know, like, it's a masterpiece.
He sort of did a Terrence Malick where he went away for a while.
He did.
He had this long gap with no movies, and now suddenly it's like bam, bam, bam. Like, you know, Deep Blue Sea was a couple years ago. This year we get two movies from him.
I'm very excited. This may not be his greatest, you know, work.
But it's lovely.
I don't think it's as good as the Deep Blue Sea.
No.
But it is, first of all, it's rapturously beautiful.
Yeah.
To look at. I don't know of another contemporary filmmaker who can make day-to-day drudgery and domesticity look as gorgeous as he does.
The opening shot is this sort of like golden field in autumn, and then suddenly Anderson just pops up out of it. And there's a lot of big sky in this movie, and
right.
A lot of, you know, awful weather because it's Scotland.
Right.
It's
beautiful to look at, but it is also a sort of classical melodrama where, you know, episodic sort of storytelling is grounded in this, you know, beautiful scenario.
Pastoral setting.
It's also, much like many of his films, it's just steeped in melancholy and that simultaneous feeling of yearning for the past and also mourning it, where you wish you could go back there, and at the same time,
like, let's not kid ourselves, it was awful.
At the same time, you grieve for how it turned out.
And in the Terrence Davis...
And I don't know, there's probably a word in German for this, or Finnish, but not in English.
And in the Terrence Davis way, there's also like those scenes where people put aside their misery for a moment.
To sing. There's quite a bit of singing in this movie.
Yeah.
People just start singing. And it's not a musical, but, no. You know, in 1910 in Scotland, you entertained yourself by sitting around singing songs with each other.
Yeah. I have to say, I mean, I know I'm not a big Carey Mulligan fan, but I bought Annis Dane as Woman of the Farm way more than I did Carey Mulligan in Far From the Madding Crowd, and I was not expecting to, because my thought was like, oh, great. You know, when they tell you a model is going to be acting, you're like, okay, we'll see how that goes. When you tell me a model is going to be acting in a turn-of-the-century farm drama from Terrence Davis, I'm like, okay. And then she was... There was nothing precious about her at all. Like, she felt very much of that time and that place.
Why do you feel that way about models?
Because... I don't know. I feel like even if you're a musician who becomes an actor, you at least have some semblance of the idea of performing, you know, and being in front of an audience, or, you know, like there's a performative
like
aspect. But models often is about, especially when it comes to being in front of an audience, is about being as blank as possible.
Right.
So it's sort of the opposite of acting. I don't know. It's not something that I necessarily think, oh, great, you know, Naomi Campbell's going to be in a movie.
Oh, come on, you would think, oh, great, Naomi Campbell were going to be in a movie.
Although she is awesome in the opening credits of Cool as Ice, but she's,
right?
But she's singing, you know.
Now, let me preface this by saying that I'm not accusing you of the thing I'm about to ask.
Oh, boy.
Do we believe that female models get a tougher road than male models? Because there are a lot of those who are in the acting game as well.
Well,
former male models.
Here's the thing. Yeah. I think that male models are less likely to become famous for being models. Whereas if you're a woman who's a model, you can become famous as a model way that Einstein did. If you're a male model and then you become an actor, unless it's in your press notes or you talk about it on talk shows, people don't necessarily know, oh, that's the guy from whatever, because there aren't guy models that reach that level of fame in modeldom the way women do. You know,
like male porn stars.
I was going to make that connection, but I thought you would be offended by it.
There are very few male porn stars.
Outside of the gay world,
yeah. The women become the names.
Exactly.
Yeah. I wonder why that is. Why don't we Why don't we
because straight
do that with male.
Because straight men are the major consumers of straight porn. They don't want to acknowledge
yeah.
that they're looking at a butt, you know.
Right. So because I think about all the male models that became actors. Jason Statham.
Mm-hmm.
Ashton Kutcher.
Right.
Richard Gere.
Yeah, but we didn't know
Selleck.
We didn't know their names from their modeling work the way that right. we know, you know, Linda and Christie and, you know, yeah. Alec Weck and whoever the
Channing Tatum was not only a model but a stripper.
Well, he was a stripper like once, I think.
No. I think he was not once.
My impression was that he was mainly like a waiter at a strip bar, and I think like he stripped a couple of times.
That's not how he tells it.
Okay, maybe I'm remembering it wrong.
Yeah. Unless I'm really wrong about how he tells it.
But. Yeah, and you know what? It took a while for Channing Tatum to get taken seriously as an actor, you'll recall.
Well, because all he did was dance in the first few movies he was in.
Right.
Yeah. Anyway.
No, I think if we talk more about women models and their work as models, it's because they got to be well-known as models, whereas male models are sort of just part of the woodwork.
So I went to the Limley Royal to see this movie that I really love and that I think, you know, you should see too.
I'm going
to
get coffee while you recount this saga.
It's not much of a saga.
Oh, you'll make it one.
I tweeted about this last night. And I think everyone should go to Twitter, D. Leland White. Follow me there. Learn the story as it unfolded in a series of 9 tweets. Chapters, I call them. It's in the small house. There's like 9, 10 other people there with me. I will be 52 in 3 weeks.
Yeah.
And I was the youngest person there. So this man and a woman, couple behind me, 2 rows behind me. Mid-70s, I'm going to guess, at least. They just talked. And one thing you'll learn when you see this film is that, as I say on Twitter, it has a deep regard for silence. There's a lot of silence in this movie. And the people behind me didn't like that. They thought silence needed to be filled with them. So they began filling it, and they talked and talked and talked, and the person who sat behind them shushed them, and it didn't stop the talking. And then after that person shushed them, I turned around in my chair, and I politely said in a normal voice, "Please stop talking." And that did not stop them. And it just kept going. They kept talking. Even if other people on screen were talking, they were talking. And after about 90 more seconds of this, maybe 2 minutes, I turned fully around. I sat up tall in my seat. And I said, "Shut up! You know how to behave in a movie theater. Shut up!" And it worked. And then when the movie was over, they waited for me out in the lobby. But they didn't speak to me in the lobby, which is funny because that's all they could figure out to do in the movie itself was talk, but they wouldn't say a word to me in the lobby. They just stared at me.
They gave you the glower?
Yeah. And I was like, I stared back at them, and I just went like,
I'm not the guilty party here.
My the funny thing about the aftermath of them staring at me in the lobby was, what did they think they were going to do to me in the lobby?
Shame you.
Were we going to go?
For disrespecting, like, your elders.
Y'all want to go? Because lady, man, older people, I could take both of you at once. It'd be like 2 pieces of paper on me. So, and don't think I wouldn't beat up an old person for being awful.
Well, the thing about those, the especially the Royal and the Music Hall here, which is the theaters where an older audience goes to see art films.
Quite old,
and even though they're the art film audience, they're still so often rude and obnoxious.
Right.
It's just like, my God, you know. And I saw Sunset Song Thursday night at the Landmark, and it was in one of the small houses where like it's sofas.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, I put myself in the back row, wanted to be away from people, but of course there were people to the left of me and people to the right of me, and this guy on my right kept checking his phone, and he would do it in that sort of like quick way, thinking like, oh, no one's going to notice.
Right.
And every time I'd be like, turn your phone off.
You would say it.
Yes.
And he would ignore you.
Several times, and he finally, I think, capitulated. But, oh, so obnoxious.
So,
it's like, go see, you know, Angry Birds, if that's your jam.
So I'm driving home yesterday, I'm trying to figure out, like, what is the mentality? Do you think, because I'm trying to put myself in the shoes of somebody who's 75,
mm-hmm.
because in 20 years, well, in 23 years,
right.
I will be 75 years old. Which doesn't seem that long from now, does it?
Yeah. You're 2/3 of the way there.
I'm so youthful and vibrant, though, I just don't see how it can happen. Anyway. When I'm 75 years old, what if I'm even worse at hearing than I am now? What if I think that I'm not being loud, but I am?
You're getting that implant.
Right, exactly. I'll have a hearing assistance device by then.
Yes.
Again, thank you, Black Flag, for that. How's that going to be at 75 years old? You know, those old hardcore punk rock shows, they did me in the 80s. Now that I'm a 75-year-old man.
That's going to be like talking about,
Black Flag took away my hearing.
I got in a roadster.
Right.
We went to a roadhouse.
A shell exploded next to me in Normandy. You know, like, that's not the same thing.
Yeah. 23 Skidoo.
So, I'm trying to think, well, what makes you do that? What makes you be that person? Do you honestly think that you weren't being heard? Or are you that kind of old person who just thinks that anything you do is fine because you're old?
Exactly. You've earned it.
Like you've somehow earned the right to break all the social contracts? Or, and this is my favorite one because it is Los Angeles, were you always a dick?
This is true. I mean, we see young people who are obnoxious and entitled all the time. It's not like they mellow out when they get older.
Right.
If anything, if their awful behavior has allowed them to succeed in the film industry, they're just going to get...
Or some other industry.
Yeah, they're just going to get worse.
So, anyway. Go see Sunset Song.
Yes.
And yell at people who talk during it.
Or turn their phone on.
Yeah.
I saw Angry Birds and you did not.
I like Ghostbusters, bro, refuse to see Angry Birds. Not because it's based on an app, but because everyone I know whose opinions I really trust and whose opinions I sort of trust, they all hate it.
Yeah, it's gotten kinder reviews than I expected it would. I mean, it is bright and colorful, you know, if bright and colorful is enough.
For children.
For children.
Yeah.
But also for children, it has stuff that if I were a parent, I would be not
annoyed by.
Thrilled about having to try to explain, like when the lead character says, pluck my life, or...
Ha ha, because it sounds like...
Something else.
Right.
You know, and you know, we've obviously gotten used to the pee and fart jokes in these movies, but this, I think, I want to say this is the first kid cartoon I have seen that has visible urine in it for a lengthy period of time.
Hmm.
Yeah, like that's the joke. But it's just really loud and grating and obnoxious, and I don't even know what the messaging of the film is supposed to be, because it's like, you know, okay, yeah, Red is the one angry bird, and then it turns out that they need his anger to rescue all the kidnapped egg babies. You know, another thing for parents, oh yeah, here's a film where everything is resolved with violence. You'll love that. And I can't even figure out what the message of the movie is, because like you've got, you know, the basically it's the birds live in this paradise and this island, and they think it's the whole world, and then suddenly a boat pops up with these green pigs in it, and then next thing you know they're being overrun by these green pigs and who act like they're their friends, but then they steal all their egg babies and go away, and so they have to go to where the green pigs live to get to steal them back. And
all I'm hearing right now is
there's not like a single nice green pig. Like they're all awful. Like they, as a race, they are terrible. So the message of the movie is basically anyone who is not like you is may pretend like they're your friend, but really they just want to eat your children. And so whether you look at this metaphorically as being about refugees or about colonization, it's just kind of gross either way.
Well, yeah.
You know, they might have maybe tried to make it a little more complex than like the app is. I was just annoyed the whole time. Yeah, it's dumb.
I don't really feel we need to discuss it.
It's not as horrible as like Freebirds or The Nut Job.
Or what was that one? Barnyard?
Oh, you saw that one. I didn't see it. Yeah. But it's just above those.
It's not like Return to Oz, Dorothy's Revenge, whatever that thing was called.
I didn't see that one either.
Oh, God.
That's another movie that Bibbs and Whitney defend.
If they do.
I think they do.
I will punch them both in the face.
Well, rev up, because I believe they did.
And like yesterday in the Art House Theater where I yelled at two old people, I will win. I will be victorious.
Oh, speaking of
someone just tweeted at me and said, unfortunately, you may shout at the wrong person in the wrong theater and it may be the day you die.
That's true. Listen,
no, I have rules for how and when I do this. Don't get me wrong. I'm not going to do it at the multiplex on a Friday night with a crowd full of, you know, 19-year-olds
right,
who may be strapped or whatever. I'm just going to move or leave or get my money back or whatever, because that's a giant wave that you can't...
Yeah, society has decided that there's nothing to be done about it.
The world has decided that if you're at a movie theater like on the weekend...
Of like a new release, a new release, wide release.
It's a bunch of young people that everyone's going to be on their phones.
Yeah.
And people are just going to be talking. And if you don't like that, you shouldn't be there.
Right.
At that time. That's just kind of life right now. Consequently, I don't go to that, really.
Unless we have to for work. Like, I remember.
But even then, it's I pick and choose.
I remember going
in the morning.
I remember going to like a Thursday night show, the opening night show of Let's Be Cops.
Yes.
And people were on their phones, and I was like,
but who cares? Because yeah, it was Let's Be Cops.
Well, there's that also. Yeah. But yeah, I just thought like there's no point in even trying to.
No. But if I'm in an art house theater, or if I'm at CineFamily.
Oh yeah, totally.
Which it has happened at CineFamily.
Yes.
If I'm anywhere like that, mm-hmm, a specialty kind of place,
yeah,
where the film is not one that you just stumbled into. You didn't just accidentally
You didn't stand at the box office and go,
Cemetery of Splendor, that sounds good. You know. If you're in there,
behave. Well,
I'm a bounce you.
When we get our draft house finally, that'll be zero tolerance for that kind of those kind of shenanigans. Yeah. We have to talk about
The Nice Guys.
Well, before that,
what?
Cancel my reservation.
Oh God.
One of the things that I love about living in Los Angeles is the breadth of repertory film programming. Because, you know, just about anywhere you live, you can probably stumble upon somebody who's screening, you know, The Big Lebowski and Casablanca, and you know, like the sort of the greatest hits of rep cinema. But when you have so many screens devoted to it year round and people putting together weird tributes to lesser figures or whatnot, like all sorts of oddball things will pop up. Like we got to see the other movie that Gene Seberg and Jean-Paul Belmondo made together, which I'd never even heard of. I don't remember the title of it now. But on my birthday this week at the New Beverly, they were screening a Bob Hope double feature. And the first film was his last film as a leading man from 1972, Cancel My Reservation, Based on a novel by Louis L'Amour, of all things.
Cancel my whole life.
And I had
is
a,
how I felt I had, about 30 minutes into
I
this.
I had a very vague memory of seeing it as a child on television. And you'd always, it would always
what
come
What was that memory? Did that memory feel... Let's be Terrence Davis about this.
Uh-huh.
Did that memory feel hazy and wistful? Did it feel like rollicking and fun?
Well, I remember being kind of confused by it because he's playing a TV talk show host in the movie.
Right.
And I mainly knew Bob Hope as a TV guy anyway. And I must have seen the dream sequence where like Johnny Carson and John Wayne and Flip Wilson and Bing Crosby show up. So I always had this weird thing about, yeah, it's this movie where he's playing a guy on TV, but he's not Bob Hope. But there are all these real people in it and there's a murder. And I was like, I just had like the vaguest clues floating around in my head.
Right.
And so I was like, oh, what the heck? They're screening this thing. And every film book that I would come across, like Malton or whatever, I was just talking about how terrible it was. But it was showing on the big screen in 35. And I was like, all right, we got to go see Cancel My Reservation. And since it was my birthday, you humored me.
I just want to say, I said this to you once, but I want to declare it to the world. Because you are my husband and because I love you, I will always go to these god-awful pieces of garbage with you for the rest of my life. No matter how stupid and awful they are. Did I say awful and awful in the same breath? That's because it's twice awful. It's awful awful. It's double awful.
It was directed by Paul Bogart, who did a ton of television, but he also did the Torch Song Trilogy movie, strangely enough, and Sondheim's Evening Primrose. It's that era of the late 60s and early 70s where movies look like TV and they're scored like TV, they sound like TV. Like everything seems like you could have just plopped it into the NBC Sunday Mystery Movie and it wouldn't have stood out as being anything different. But Bob Hope, who is 69 at this point, playing a character who says he's 42. Is a New York talk show host. He is currently arguing a lot with his wife, Eva Marie Saint, because she has somehow become his co-host against his wishes. He has like a panic attack or something, and his doctor prescribes that he like go off to their vacation house in Arizona by himself and relax. And then he keeps stumbling across a series of dead bodies and that are in a series that makes him look like he's a killer. And the wife comes out to sort of help him sort it out. And a very young Ann Archer is in it. And Ralph Bellamy and Keenan Wynn. And, there's all this stuff with like an Indian, like a Native American, mystic who has visions. And it ain't good. It does, however, have a really catchy, dumb theme song that I've had stuck in my head all week. It's co-written by, I think, Bobby Hart of Boyce and Hart.
Bobby Hart, yeah.
Yeah, so it's, if you like the Ambushers theme, you'd like this one too, maybe. Anyway.
Both of you who know the Ambushers theme.
So it was...
It goes like this. They're the Ambushers. There. That's how the song goes.
So this was terrible, but I'm glad I saw it just to sort of resolve my sort of childhood, my vague memory of it on TV.
I fell asleep for a good 15 minutes in the middle of the film.
Mm.
And when I woke up, I thought, now I don't know what's happening. Good. I'm going to think about other things. Like, should I do colors or whites tomorrow when I wash the laundry? What should I think about making for dinner?
It is not on...
I wonder how much those mugs are going to cost to ship.
Because,
I'm probably right.
Because it is not...
It's going to be like $6. Yeah.
Because it is not on video, I don't mind telling you that the entire movie is on YouTube if you want to see it. Don't.
I implore you, do not. But if you're curious, I want to know if anyone's just so dying to find out.
Mm. It's also that weird later Bob Hope thing of him like, doing a one-liner, and the movie like waits for the audience to laugh, kind of thing. And so it's just like tons of dead pockets.
I want to know how many minutes in you get. Let's say you go look at this on YouTube. How many minutes before you bail? How many minutes before you feel like,
nope,
you know what?
Can't do it.
You know what? Life is so beautiful. And this is
and short.
This is not contributing to that. I want to know how many minutes you last. There. That is my challenge to you, curious listeners who think you're going to go to YouTube and watch Cancel My Reservation or however the hell that song goes. That stupid song that you think is catchy.
It is catchy.
It's not that catchy.
Okay, I'm sorry. Are you saying stupid... Bam, 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 are you saying bam, stupid bam, songs bam, bam, can't be catchy? Because I beg to differ. Stupid songs are the catchiest.
They are, yeah, yeah. What's that one? That la, 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 la. What's that song?
Oh, yeah.
Something around
it
the
goes
world.
Around the world. La, 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 la. Exactly. Please, jingles. You know, they're designed to stick in your head.
Right. All right, so we both saw The Nice Guys.
Yes.
Why don't you tell people? Why don't you tell people what happens in The Nice Guys?
Okay.
I'm letting you. I talked about Sunset Song. You can do everything else.
Fine. Yeah. I'm not doing everything else.
I don't want to dominate you. It's been your birthday. It was your birthday.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Okay. So The Nice Guys is Shane Black's third film as a director. He's a very successful writer. He basically sort of revamped the whole 80s action film genre with movies like Lethal Weapon. And he directed Kiss Kiss Bang Bang and Iron Man 3. And now he is back in the sort of buddy cop genre, although they're buddy detectives. It's set in 1977.
They're not really buddies.
Well, they're not buddies. Well, at first, obviously, they're mortal enemies. And then they begrudgingly become pals because that's how these movies work.
Right.
So yeah, it's 1977 Los Angeles, and it's smoggy and decadent and crumbling. And Ryan Gosling is a widowed private eye who is trying to help a woman track down her daughter who is presumed dead. And in the course of his investigation, he crosses paths with a woman who has hired enforcer Russell Crowe to take care of the guy who she claims is stalking her. So Russell Crowe goes to Ryan Gosling's house and breaks his arm. But then it turns out that there's a much more complicated conspiracy going on, and the woman who hired Russell Crowe has gone missing as well, and these goons come after Russell Crowe to try and find her, so he realizes that he has to team up with Ryan Gosling to find her and figure out what's going on. As usual in these kinds of movies, the caper itself makes very little sense and is rather...
Well,
It's excessively labyrinthine.
Yeah.
Involving both the automotive and adult film industries.
And environmentalism.
Yes.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's Shane Black. So there's a lot of great rat-a-tat kind of banter, which Gosling and Crowe are very good at. I was a little put off by some of the tone of the film. You know, if you want to have a violent comedy where... like bad guys get shot or the good guys get shot, even like fine, whatever, that you can pull that off in the right sort of attitude. But when you start picking off innocent bystanders who just happen to be like standing in a window in an apartment across the street or next to the valet stand, it's kind of like, oh,
you know what? That sometimes just happens to you if you live in Los Angeles.
Well, sure, but it's
you
not
get shot.
But it's not funny.
You know, it's interesting. I didn't consider those deaths to be played for laughs.
Well, they're not played for laughs per se, but they're portrayed as part of the landscape of what is supposed to be a comedy. And
are dying,
and it took me out of it. You know, it's like you know, that takes me out of the sort of violent whimsy of the film. You know.
I guess I see what you're talking about. I don't really feel like he's flippant about it. I feel like it's part of the grimy world that they exist in.
Mm.
Yeah.
I mean, overall, I like the film a lot. I think it's very funny. I think it's very entertaining. I like the performances. I just wasn't crazy about that. And also the handling of Gosling's, like, tween daughter who is his caretaker who drives him around because he's drunk and, you know, winds up at a porn party sitting next to a porn star watching her latest movie. It's just kind of like, Okay. Again. I know. He's going for the 70s.
The sleazy 70s.
Yeah, but it's...
A decade that, if you did not live through it, is somewhat difficult to understand how it existed.
True.
Now, I was a child, and so were you.
As children, we knew who Linda Lovelace was.
Exactly.
Even if we weren't quite sure why she was
how
famous.
How is it... Here's the situation. People get all their, you know, their knickers in a bunch about children being exposed to this or that, you know, thing. But when you and I were elementary school-aged children,
yeah,
Linda Lovelace became a star.
She was on The Tonight Show.
And her movie, Deep Throat, was a common topic of conversation.
Yeah.
Pornography was being mainstreamed into non-pornographic theaters.
Yeah, it was this brief moment where...
Where they really were saying, okay, well, this is the next wave of American permissive filmmaking.
Cinema, yeah. And couples would go to them in first-run theaters.
Porn movies in regular movie theaters. And it did happen with Deep Throat and perhaps a couple other ones. I'm not sure exactly.
Yeah.
I was, you know, again, a child.
Behind the Green Door, I think there were a few that, that
and
were...
And all I knew was that these movies had an X rating, which was even naughtier than an R rating.
Right.
And that... The ladies had no clothes on. And that's everything I understood about it. Grown-ups would go see movies about naked ladies. And I don't know what happened in those movies, except the naked ladies would lie around and sort of like roll around and stuff. And sometimes the men were naked too, but I didn't know why they were there or what was like. Who could understand this? And it's not like your parents were going to tell you.
Right.
But... That stuff was in the world, and you had a highly sexualized popular culture where, well, for example, we've discussed this before, you know, the groupie phenomenon of rock musicians, the GTOs, these 13-year-old, 14-year-old girls who would travel in packs up and down the Sunset Strip, stalking... Rock stars.
Right.
Men who were at least 10 years older than they were. And part of the culture was, you know, well, oh yeah, they probably just want to go have sex. These 13-year-old girls.
Yeah.
And people would just say, well, I guess that's the sexual revolution. And it never occurred to a lot of people, I guess. Yeah. I mean, again, I was 7, but it was presented as, well, here's the way things are going to be now. Normal. This is normal.
Yeah.
And so for Shane Black to have a 13-year-old girl.
She's not 13, do you think?
What?
I thought she was like 11 or 12.
No, they'd say she's 13.
Is she 13?
They say she's 13 in the movie.
Okay.
And that to have her at a party for porn people and to be sitting there watching a porn movie with the woman who's in the movie... I feel like as a big cinema person, which he is, mm-hmm. you know, there's this whole scene near the end of the movie where there's like a projector being,
right, you know,
a big projection, a reel of film being used as a weapon and
rolling down the street.
Yeah, yeah. It's a, you know, this is commentary.
Yeah.
He's referencing films like Taxi Driver and Pretty Baby and stuff like that where you had young female actors, Jodie Foster and Brooke Shields, respectively, right. as sexual beings in these films. They both played prostitutes in the films they were in. And that was one of the themes of the film. Child prostitution is happening. And that's life now.
Right.
And so, the 70s are a weird decade that we have, you know, we've pulled back as culture from that level of...
If you never watched the show Swingtown...
Indulgence or, you know...
There's a great
episode... People would call rape culture now.
There's a great episode about where they're throwing a fundraising party for the producers of Deep Throat who are suing for their First Amendment rights, basically. Yeah. I get that. I have to say, in the moment, it just sort of caught me like, hey.
Does catch you off guard, and it makes you think about, if you're old enough, it makes you think, oh, we don't like this now, you know. And
yeah,
and,
no, I will say
and
that
back
that,
then it was sort of a tolerated, you
as
know,
the
idea.
The further I get from the film, the more I think about it, the more I understand what that part is about. But the other stuff still kind of was a little off-putting. But I still recommend the film. I still think people should see it.
It's
I think
very
it's
funny.
A lot of fun.
It's it is if nothing else. It's a film for adults that's smart and funny and really violent.
Yes.
And it is not, it's not part of an existing franchise. It's not a spinoff. It's not a branded
commodity.
It's not a branded other object that's now being turned into a film. It is an original screenplay by a filmmaker that I like.
Yeah, me too.
Quite a bit. And who takes genre conventions and turns them into his own personal, you know, myth making, and I'm pro that 100%. And so, and Ryan Gosling and Russell Crowe are really cool together.
Yeah, no, in my review of The Wrap, I said I would love to see a sequel with the two of them at the 1984 Los Angeles Summer Olympics.
Right. Did we talk about the weird green screen?
Which part?
Oh, wait, no, that's Neighbors 2.
Oh, okay.
That's Neighbors 2.
Oh, God, yes, that's some of the worst green screen I've ever seen
in a
movie.
There's a lot of green screen in The Nice Guys, but it's mostly people in Los Angeles who are going to know the difference.
Right.
Because you're going to see something that you know, and you're going to say, wait, that's not there. I guess maybe that used to be there.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, they you can tell that Black was excited to sort of bring back 77 Los Angeles. So, right. You know, the Hollywood sign is crumbling. There's billboards up for Smoking the Bandit and Jaws 2.
Right.
You know, and to the I almost felt like, oh, you wanted this movie to be about the auto industry and the porn world just so you could have, like, the 1978 auto show and, like, you know, this Boogie Nights porn party in it, you know.
Yeah.
But it works.
There is, if you're paying attention very closely, there's a little bit of mustache continuity going on with Ryan Gosling that doesn't always make sense. One minute it's
Fu Manchu-ish,
straight up across, and the next minute it's droopy like a Fu Manchu. Mm. It's and it's set in 1977, and they do take a little bit of liberties with soundtrack songs.
Which ones?
A Boogie Wonderland, in particular, which came out in 1979.
Oh,
and wait, let me see what else. I've been typing titles into. yeah, A Taste of Honey's Boogie Oogie Oogie, all the Boogie songs.
Ah,
that's from 1978. Mm. So you know, they're playing a little fast and loose with.
I rather liked Yaya DaCosta in this.
Well, yeah, she has a small role, but
memorable.
Yeah,
and Matt Bomer has some moments as a
yeah
creepy.
The real star is
Angouri Rice.
Angouri Rice.
Yeah,
and how do I?
A N G O U R I E.
Where's she come from?
She's Australian.
Oh, is she?
Yeah,
doing an American accent.
Yeah.
at 13.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's like remember you know with Saoirse Ronan in that. In that Amy Heckerling movie, had a dead on American.
So she's been in some Australian things, and she was in, she was a voice with Walking with Dinosaurs 3D.
Right.
So she's great.
Yeah, she's very charming.
She's the hero of the movie, really.
Kind
of,
yeah.
Yeah. So Neighbors 2.
Sorority Rising. It's fun. It's a lot of fun.
So very funny.
If you like the first one, you know, this is the kind of comedy sequel where they want to give you another version of that, and they do, and they do it well.
The premise is that Seth Rogen and Rose Byrne are going to have another baby, and they decide they want a bigger house. They move, they sell their house, and it goes into escrow. And then they have to be explained. They have to have the realtor explain escrow to them again, which honestly is great because the scene where they're being explained, where escrow is being explained to them, they stand there looking slack-jawed and stupid.
Well, after having insisted, of course, no, we understand escrow.
Of course
we get it. Explain it again.
And that was great because not being a homeowner, I've rented my entire adult life. and have no intention to ever buy a house. I didn't know what escrow really was about either. It's a word I know, but I never had to learn it. And so it's that 30-day period. It's kind of like the cooling off period, really, where the 30 days go by and the new buyers
can change their mind.
They can, you know, find out that there's mold, that whatever it is.
Yeah.
And so in the 30-day escrow, nothing can go wrong, really, for the seller. So the fraternity from the first movie has moved out of the house next door. And now a sorority is coming in. And it's not just any sorority. It's sort of a unofficial renegade sorority. Chloe Grace Moretz and some other girls who...
The girl from Dope.
Oh, is that who that is?
Yeah.
Okay. I knew I'd seen her before.
Yeah. And Jonah Hill's sister.
Oh, is that Jonah Hill's sister?
Yeah.
Okay. She's funny. They decide they want a party.
Because it turns out, if you have a sorority...
Another thing I learned.
You cannot throw parties at a sorority house. That's
anywhere in the United
States. Yeah, like, that's a real thing. The movie even tells you to go Google it if you don't believe it.
Right.
And
so they move in, they want a party and be loud and wild. And meanwhile, Zac Efron, who used to run the fraternity that lived next door, he's moved out of the house and in with his roommate and best friend, Dave Franco. But at the very beginning of the film, Dave Franco's boyfriend proposes to him and they decide they're going to get married and they don't want to have a roommate anymore. So they ask Zac Efron
to move out.
Zac Efron is kind of the MVP of this movie.
he's very funny.
I have really warmed up to him as an idiot character.
He is a very capable actor that doesn't get enough chances to show it. But yeah. I think that he's gonna surprise us all.
He's moving down the Channing Tatum road. It seems like to me. Inch by inch, people are gonna start taking him seriously.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I don't think this Wedding Dates movie is going to be a step in the right direction.
Oh, no, I think it's going to be terrible.
But, you know...
Just a hunch.
Yeah, like, he needs to make less Dirty Grandpas and Charlie St. Clouds and more, like, you know... I mean, I had problems with the Paperboy, but at least he was doing something interesting.
If nothing else, is audacious.
Yes.
So.
And these movies, he's, you know, he gets to be really funny.
Really funny, and it's so smart how they take his character on this ride, because he panics, he realizes he has no roommate anymore, no place to live. He's jobless because Abercrombie and Fitch has discarded their shirtless male models that stand outside the stores. Again, a real life thing that has stopped in real life.
And now he's older than all the other people that work there.
Yeah.
His post-college life, he's got like nothing going on.
He's 22, 23, but he's older than everyone else at Abercrombie and Fitch, so he feels cast aside from there. He runs back to the fraternity house just in a sweat, in a panic, and he just sort of turns into a wraith
that
hangs around the house. The girls come in and they're like, "What's that hot guy doing here?" And they explain what they want. And he says, "I can help you. I know how to party. I know how to help you set up a sorority because I know how to set up a fraternity. So I'll do this for you." And they realize that they've got to fight Rogan and Rose Byrne again.
Yes.
Alliances change, things shift.
The dirty tricks are committed.
Pranks happen. The girls teach feminism to Zac Efron. In a way that is so brilliantly funny and smart, and at the same time highlights the legitimate cultural confusion going on right now about a new, really assertive wave of young feminism that a lot of people who are older, and particularly male, are still trying to wrap their heads around. And the film takes all this stuff head on and folds it in to the gross out humor and the pranks in a way that feels really smart and sly and light on its feet. It is a fully feminist comedy, almost in disguise, in a really cool way. It's, for me, I think it's better than the first movie. It is as funny, but has more to say about the world. And the characters are sometimes resistant, sometimes confused, sometimes fully on board. Sometimes enemies become friends and friends become enemies. And you never know exactly where, you know, the beats are going to land. And I had a great time at this film.
I liked it a lot. I laughed consistently. I would put it about on par with the first one. And I think, yeah, it does fold in a lot of ideas. My one qualm about the female characters was it, I didn't believe how not sexual they were. And I don't mean like, oh, I wanted to see the they needed to be more naked or whatever. But I mean, you know, the whole thing about this sorority is like we've been living at home all our lives. We finally were at college. We get to break free. We get to smoke weed. We get to drink. And I would think you would also want to have sex. And like, yes, I get that, you know, part of why you're starting this off-campus sorority is because only the frat parties, only the frats get to throw parties. And they're very, as the movie puts it, rapey, you know. Yeah. And so, yeah, I get it. You don't want to have sex with those guys and not in, in a circumstance that you're not in control. But if you've got this house and all this agency, and even if it's not with Zac Efron, who is under your roof, with somebody, surely. I mean, like, there's even one, you know, one that you see this sort of montage of like theme parties, and one of them is like the Chloe Grace Moretz character like loses her virginity, but they never tell you to who, you know, and it just all seems that was I thought if a woman had written or directed this movie, there would have been some mention of the fact that these gals, in addition to getting high and drunk, were also getting laid and getting laid in a way that they were comfortable with and in control of.
Yeah. You know, it's a movie made by guys, and I, my understanding, I read about it after the fact, there were a couple of uncredited female screenwriters.
Oh, interesting.
Who came in and sort of like, no, fix this, do this, change that, make this, beef up that.
Right.
After the fact, I learned that the virginity loss scene had been shot, but they got rid of it.
Hmm.
And apparently she lost it to Zac Efron.
Ah.
Yeah. So, but in a way that she turns the tables and makes him like the passive submissive person.
Right.
I don't know. I'm not sure exactly. I'm sure it's going to be on the Blu-ray.
Right.
I feel like, you know, guys wrote this movie and I feel like they may have been a little
timid
about how they might portray female sexuality.
Yeah.
And so they probably just held back. You know,
probably, yeah, but that's a minor quibble. I had a good time. It's absolutely worth checking out, especially if you like the first one.
So, DVDs.
I have two this week, both based on auteurs who we discussed on this episode, and both mentioned over the course of the show. Terrence Davis' "The Long Day Closes." Which is a sort of memory piece about being a little kid obsessed with movies in the 1950s in England. There's a beautiful Criterion set for that. And then Shane Black's Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, which is one of my favorite contemporary Christmas movies, but I think just has really smart dialogue and three great lead performances from Robert Downey Jr., Michelle Monaghan, and Val Kilmer. Just is a fun LA movie in terms of, especially, you know, Black loves the sort of artificiality of LA at Christmas. There's only one Christmas moment in The Nice Guys. I was surprised. I thought, you know, he usually goes full tilt boogie on that kind of thing, even in Iron Man 3. But yeah, I adore Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, and it's a movie that didn't do a lot when it came out, but it sort of has a slowly growing cult. So if you've never seen it, by all means, check it out.
The Deep Blue Sea.
Not the one with not the shark one.
Not the one with the sharks.
The Rachel Weisz one.
The Rachel Weisz one. Terrence Davies' film about a woman, a suicidal, despondent woman, in the years after World War II. And the affair she begins with a young man, Tom Hiddleston.
Yes, a flyboy.
It's kind of a doomed affair. But it's about finding your life, even through, you know, very dark, difficult circumstances. And it's gorgeous. She's amazing. And again, underloved.
Yeah. Her performance is extraordinary. It's some of her best work.
So there, that one. You want some letters?
Yeah.
We have exactly 8 minutes left.
Okay.
Before I have to run away.
Yes.
Let's pull up some letters that I'm doing right now. Here are some letters that I'm sending you. Oh, look. Rowan Greaves.
Yes.
Of Australia. Talking about t-shirts, but then he says, this is a Patreon message. He said this on Patreon. He's a subscriber, and he's...
It turns out that the linoleumpodcast@gmail.com account was eating all of his emails. I never got any of them.
After we learned all this, and I said it right, and I gave him my personal email address to send letters to the show to, he posted on Patreon and said, I talked to Dave. I couldn't bring myself to mention that I once worked with Kylie Minogue. Perhaps he thought I would maybe explode in glee and happiness. He says, I couldn't bring myself to mention that I once worked with Kylie, but I did suggest that you guys really have to get to Sydney sometime so that I can take you on my planned Starstruck tour.
Yes.
Explain Starstruck to people who might not know.
1982, I think, musical directed by Gillian Armstrong. It was her follow-up to My Brilliant Career, which really kind of kicked off the Australian new wave of the late 1970s. And that was a very sort of, you know, not stately, but it was a period piece about a woman writer in, you know, turn-of-the-century Australia. And this is a candy-colored new wave musical, and it's one of my favorite movies.
He says, I want to take you on the Starstruck tour, hopefully complete with brunch with the director.
Oh, well.
So I guess he knows her.
Maybe.
That would be crazy.
She has a great new documentary about the costume designer Ori Kelly called Women He's Undressed, which if you have a chance to see it, you totally should.
Okay. Now here is his actual list for knifing.
He gives a list. Okay.
And a letter. Yeah. Okay. And because he sent so many letters to the show, and they've all been just devoured by the void. I'm going to read this whole thing.
Okay.
Dear Misters White and Duralde, a.k.a. Cartoon Dog and Alfonso, I write for multiple reasons. Firstly, to express how much delight I have received from your program as a listener of around 4 years. I discovered the podcast after it was first mentioned by Bibbs and Whitney.
Oh, well, thank you.
Secondly, you recently requested details about your listeners. Well, I am a 52-year-old, I'm fixing to be that too, bald, also fixing to be that too. Saw a picture of my brother yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
He and his wife were at a wedding, and they posted it on Facebook. My older brother, the one whose body type I share, like he and I are built like my father, and the other two brothers are built like the Hodges side of the family. Sort of lean.
Yeah.
But Mark and I are fatties. Saw a picture of Mark yesterday at this wedding. Bald AF. Like, hair on the sides, up top. And each passing week in my life, I just see more and more scalp.
Well, that's the thing about having older brothers. It's like the future map of your head. You know?
Yeah. Listen, the future map of your head is just going to be snowy white. You're not going to lose a bit of it.
I don't know. They've all got more forehead than I do. I think that there may be some of this going on.
Maybe.
We'll see.
That might happen. Either way.
I am follicularly blessed.
Yes, you are. I am follicularly doomed. Bald, chunky, straight Australian who has spent his life foolishly pursuing a career as a theater director, as in stage, not hospital operating theater. Most importantly, I write to overcome recent paranoia that I was the outcast child of the linoleum knife family. Over the last 6 months, I've sent you several emails hoping for a knifing each Monday morning, Sunday evening, your time. I would dash to the internet in the hope of hearing my message to you read on my favorite podcast. Alas, it never happened. With each announcement that you were catching up on neglected emails or had now emptied your mailbag, I died a little inside. Look, if this is happening to anybody else, contact us via Patreon, if Facebook. You're a subscriber. If you're not, find us on Facebook and say, hey, it's happening to me too, because who knows who else it's happening to.
Yeah, if we're not getting your letters, we don't know we're not getting your letters.
We've got people so angry at us they quit listening, you know? I mean, maybe they just got bored. But maybe. Also, maybe they're passionately angry.
Yeah.
Today I realized that my email address might have been causing my messages to go straight into your trash. So, with your assistance, I've now found a solution. And now I beg, please, sirs, can I have my knifing? The attached list is not the 10 best films ever made or even the 10 films I always recommend. It's a list of 10 films which I saw between the ages of 7 and 18. Why he chose those years, I do not know. Which have had a profound effect on me. It's the 10 films. Oh, okay. It's the 10 films which have made me occasionally critically... which have made me the occasionally critically reviled theater director I am today. With sincere thanks for all the genuine LOL moments, let alone the consistently fabulous insights into both contemporary cinema and the life of my favorite pair of Americans, Rowan. P.S. Cate Blanchett, put that latte down. He told me that's something I said once on a show. I don't remember in what context.
Me neither.
I don't remember saying it. Like I've said many times before, when the microphone is turned off, I forget everything that just happened.
I occasionally go back and re-listen to some old shows, but yeah, a lot of times I've had people quote stuff and I'm like, okay, we said that? I don't know.
In no particular order.
Okay.
2001 A Space Odyssey, of course.
Great.
Yes. Blow Up, yes.
Okay.
Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf?
Yeah.
Harold and Maude.
Mm-hmm.
The Tin Drum.
Mm-hmm.
The Magic Christian.
No.
Have you seen it?
Yes.
He explains. Perhaps you don't know this one. It's a flawed British 60s class satire with Peter Sellers and Ringo Starr. But it has much bizarreness, which must be seen, including Lawrence Harvey as a stripping Hamlet.
Yes.
And a cross-dressing Yul Brynner serenading a sleazy lounge lizard played by Roman Polanski. I am not making this up.
Yeah, it's a bizarre film, but its points about class and such are delivered with sledgehammer delicacy.
Oh, really?
Yes.
I've never even heard of this movie.
Okay.
So.
I think Badfinger's Come and Get It either comes from that movie or at least was used in that movie. Yeah. Not good, though.
Well, I have to give him the benefit of the doubt.
All right.
Beyond the Valley of the Dolls.
Yes.
The Ruling Class.
Yeah.
All that jazz.
Mm-hmm.
If.
Mm. Yeah.
Parenthetically, he says, Dave, please finally see this film. It's still my favorite.
You've never seen If?
Which is probably not rational, but I have not. But having attended a school much like the one it depicts, it was impossible not to fall in love with it as a 13-year-old. Plus, it had boobies.
Dave, as a school teacher, you would totally dig it.
You are 95% knife,
yes.
Rowan.
Yes, you are.
I'll watch If.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, we're done. That's the one letter we have time for this week.
Okie doke. Well, as everybody, as always, thank you for listening. This next week, the Outfest schedule gets announced. I'm very excited about that, and we'll talk about that some next week. But in the meantime, go check out our friends on the internet. Go to ChristyLemire.com. Listen to the Rotten Tomatoes podcast with Matt and Gray, the B-Movies podcast, and Cancel Too Soon with Bibbs and Whitney, the Schmoes Know, the Sewers of Paris, the Joel Ryan thing, the Bret Easton Ellis podcast, Dennis Anyone with Dennis Hensley, the Criterion cast, Fat Guys of the Movies, Film Spotting SVU, Game Night Guys, and Secretly Timid. Thank you, Blue, for our wonderful theme music, blutopia.com, BLEU TOPIA. Go like our show on Facebook, follow us on Twitter and Instagram at LinoleumCast. Leave us a review on iTunes. We did get a nice 4-star review that I don't have in front of me, so I don't have the name. But thank you for that. Thank you for everybody who tweets about the show or Facebooks about the show.
4 stars is fine. It's fine.
And you can always drop us a line at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com or join our club at patreon.com/linoleumknife. We will be back next week. Have a good one.
Goodbye.